Welcome to the Independent Artist Podcast, sponsored by the National Association of Independent Artists.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. I'm Will Armstrong, and I'm a mixed media artist.
I'm Douglas Sigworth, glassblower. Join our conversations with professional working artists.
Ladies and gentlemen, everybody, folks, artists everywhere, here where we are, back at the podcast. Douglas?
Yeah?
What's going on?
What's going on? Well, we're trying to fit this in today. You know, we tried yesterday and we had some technical difficulties, and thanks to our guest's daughter, she was able to fix it. So we're going to redo. We're going to be able to record with our guest and my dream guest, Bill Kidd, today. So I'm really excited
about
that. Oh, nice.
Bill Kidd's got a little in-house tech support. He's another one of the rock stars of our community, and proud to have him on. And the elusive Bill Kidd. How about that? Yeah. That sounds awesome. I love that guy.
Yeah.
Excited about that here in a minute. Yeah. We got a few minutes to catch up before we bring him on to the show, Douglas.
That sounds good.
Everything going good in your world? You and Renee getting ready for your first shows?
It's been total studio time and loving it. I was thinking about this today. Being back in the studio, people might have different feelings about getting to work on your art and everything. But for me, it's just like I get to play all day with one of my favorite people out there in the studio. So it has been such a pleasure the last few weeks just to be back at it and doing our thing.
Nice. So. That's awesome. And Renee's feeling invigorated too, probably from having a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
And, getting out there and making some good work. I can't wait to see what you're working on.
One thing that we are struggling with, you know, I often bring up equipment woes on the podcast here, but just because that's the nature of my medium.
Sure.
Initially, when we built our studio, I built all the equipment myself.
Hmm.
And so the last piece of equipment, it's this little oven. It's about the size of two shoeboxes, and it's dedicated to picking up our color or heating up our color.
Okay.
That we use in our glass. And it's like critical. It's supposed to get the glass to 950 degrees so that when we stick it at the end of the blowpipe and put it into a 2000 degree oven, we don't have glass exploding everywhere.
Gotcha.
So that has been a total pain because it is inconsistently turning off on us at, you know, bad times and all that kind of stuff. And we can't make our work when the color oven doesn't work. So
sure.
That's been a pain in my ass. But figuring it out, and maybe me and Bill can do a little equipment talk here in a few minutes.
Oh, that'll be fascinating for everyone. Yeah, trust me. We're all going to love that. Maybe we could talk about that off of the air.
There you go. Okay. The check. That's good. Yeah, we'll do that.
All right. Sounds good.
How about you? What's going on over in Santa Fe?
You know, I thought it was interesting. I was thinking about your first two shows coming up. We share the first one. I'll see it on Main Street there in Fort Worth.
Right on. That's great.
Yeah. Something kind of struck me. You guys are setting your year up. You're a little bit rusty. You've got the first two shows in a row where you don't necessarily have to set up a tent, do you? I mean, you're into the big top of other people's tents.
That could be a pro, but it's also a con because every year it's like a new puzzle. I mean, I've done both of the shows that I'm doing. We're talking Jazz Fest and Main Street Fort Worth.
La-ti-da. Look how fancy.
Yeah. Show drop.
Oh, show dropping. Look at you. That is sexy. That's a sexy lineup, my friend. All right.
It isn't.
All right, totally. Continue.
But I've done it enough times, not to humble brag here, but to know what I'm up against.
Yeah.
This time, I've kind of thought ahead. I don't set my entire tent up. I have a trim line, but I need the framework in order to put the rest of my booth together.
Right.
Not so much Main Street, but more so Jazz Fest. There are obstructions that you don't get a full 10 by 10.
Well, Main Street, it depends. It can get a little tight. I've got a couple of pieces of advice after you finish here.
Oh, okay, sure. Well, one thing I tried was I called Flourish and asked if they ever make any like custom bars that, you know, are 6 inches shorter. And they said, we will make you custom pieces. So I ordered those up and hopefully that's going to be my fix this year, that I'll be able to have a shorter framework, maybe like a 9.5 by 10 foot booth. And we're going to give that a shot and see how that works.
So what we're talking about, folks, if you have not done the show, the crux of the show takes place there on Main Street under their big tops.
Mm-hmm.
And you put your booth in there and they give you a 10 by 10. It's a tight 10 by 10. I'll tell you what I do. I've never set a tent up under their tent. I've never done it.
It seems like a weird concept, doesn't it? A tent in a tent.
I mean, it does, right? But everybody feels like they've got, I mean, you need your structure in order to set up your walls. Like you need that. You need to have that. That's the way your display is. I personally, I'm just a pro panel guy. There seems to be like a support under their big top every year where I can just use my spreader bars and jam it up and tighten it all up and get it all very sturdy. And we all talk about like these different configurations. Typically, I like to give my people an exit. I don't like to cram them in. But at that particular one, it's like, you know, when you're under somebody else's tent, it's like, I call it a horseshoe display, right? It's like 9 pro panels, 3 on the left, 3 on the back, 3 on the right, just a horseshoe. And it's like, there's my display. I'll light it up, make it as welcoming as I can and try to draw the people in. But if you don't have a corner, there's no place for them to escape. And that's just the way it is, you know?
Right. Yeah. It also seems like with those tents, if you can get your pro panels or whatever walls you're doing high enough that it meets with the, you know what I mean, the framework of the tent, then you won't have like water rushing in when you close up for the night. So that's always been a thing. So yeah, I don't need the top or the canopy or whatever to make it work. So
And it only works for you if you have the extenders on your pro panels. I've got the 30-inch tall extenders that, you know, you take those little bullets in the tops. And so it goes like a full, almost 9 feet, I guess it is. And so that braces right underneath the lip of what their tent is typically. So that's how I deal with it. And man, 9 pro panels and all of my artwork and no tent. I feel like I feel free.
You could show up in a Volkswagen.
You know what I'm thinking about? Honestly, I'm thinking about, I drive a Jeep around town, just a Jeep Wrangler. And I was thinking about pulling a small trailer down there and just doing that instead of renting. It's like renting for that in Southlake, because I got Southlake the following weekend. Got a double there, so I'll need, you know, everything. God, I'm almost thinking about just a small trailer and pulling it. Can you imagine?
You know how to drive that thing, right?
Yeah, I know how to drive that thing. God damn right. I'll teach you how to drive a trailer. I'll back it through a camel's eye. What? Camel's eye? What?
Yeah, easy? I don't know that phrase. But yeah,
no, it's expression. Not. I'm turning into my uncle. He used to mix his metaphors. I'll drive it through a camel's eye. No. My dad would laugh about that. It's easier to fit a camel through a needle's eye than it is a rich man into the gates of heaven. That is
a Bible reference for anyone who does not know.
We know our Bibles. We've all.
Hey, I wanted to bring up from last episode. Remember when I was saying, "Oh, I got to get my booth shot before I head out to the first show."
Yeah.
And you're like, "Well, it's 70 degrees now, but you're going to be bitching next week when there's a foot of snow on the ground."
Yep.
You might be a little bit psychic there, sir. There's a foot of snow on the ground. There'll be no booth shots before I leave in a couple of weeks here.
Okay. Only because I listened to my wife. I told her, I was like, "Well, it's spring, huh?" And she was like, "Simmer down, Virginia boy. This is New Mexico. It's a different world, you know? We've never had spring break that it did not snow. The ski hill up in Ski Santa Fe got 42 inches of fresh powder just in the last 72 hours alone.
Wow.
So they're not shutting it down just yet. So everybody, all the youngins are having a nice ski-y spring break.
Yeah.
I used to say if it snowed during spring break, for every day it snowed, you get an extra day of spring break. My kids don't realize how much I hated school. Like I really, like if they were like, "Hey, can I not go?" I'd be like, "Fuck yeah, absolutely." But they do so great. They do so well at school. They've got great grades. They're crushing it. And I'm like, "Don't listen to dad. Don't ask dad how he feels."
Right.
You're wasting your homework. Rots your brain.
Oh, man. Hey, so something else I wanted to bring up is, I like to talk about stuff outside of art shows that kind of inspire me. But this kind of ties back into the whole art show life. And that is a documentary or a series I watched on Netflix. And it's one of those shows that talks about, like, you are what you eat, I think is the title of it. Mm. And it's a pro-vegan documentary.
Okay.
And it shows, like, just how awful meat is and, those kinds of foods are for the human body. And
sure.
And so I happen to be on a health kick these days. Like, last September, I decided that if I'm going into the second surgery, I want to try and kind of clean up my diet. And just get in a place where I'm lighter on these feet of mine.
Definitely. You did not, honestly, coming out of that first one, you came back to it like that good foot, or the foot that you're dragging yourself around on, was working overtime. You put on a couple of LBs.
LBs, bro. Anyway, so it's already been on my mind, and we thought we would check this out. And it was fascinating. But it made me think about how over the years I have times where I was a little more diligent with my, you know, eating clean, and then other times. But what often derails me is heading out to shows. I mean, how do we maintain a healthy lifestyle with the kinds of foods we want to eat on the road? Do you struggle with that? Or you probably have never even had to worry about that ever in your life.
I have, sure. You know, if you are what you eat, I might be a breakfast burrito. But
there you go.
No, I mean, you do try. You know, I my blood pressure is a little bit high. I'm 53, and you know, I got to get the blood work done here for my physical this week, actually. And it's funny you say all of that, but like, there's a great line. I've used it here on the show before, but diesel smoke and diner fries, we won't be young for long. It's old Slade Cleave song talking about being on the road. And I love radio, and I love music, and I love putting together playlists and things. So many artists have song, whether it's, you know, all the way back to Bob Seger and Turn the Page, you know, all these artists singing about being on the road and how hard it is. And a lot of it is the you don't get to eat the way you want to eat. And, I don't know. I've got my cooler kit. I typically eat pretty healthy during the show, and then just do whatever the hell I want at night.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, you're at a busy show. You don't really have that time to eat that much, but you need your fuel, right? But
Like, there have been times when Renee and I it felt like it was like a whole day where we would prepare food for the weekend and pack like this massive camping cooler full of stuff. There's just certain things that we like to have that are healthy, and it was great to have it accessible when we're there. But it's just another thing to add to the list you're trying to get the hell out the door.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I have my like mental cooler kit. I'll do like a big thing of hummus, a thing of baby carrots. I've got the waterproof Tupperware thing that can sink down to the cooler, so you don't get cooler water in your food. There's nothing nastier than cooler water. That's just, you know.
No, that's so gross.
It's so disgusting. So you open up your hummus and you got like a half an inch cooler water. I've been offered that by another artist. Hey, you want some hummus? And then they dump the cooler water off top. And I was like, no, I don't want any nasty ass. Because the outside of your IPA bottle and your everything else. But I don't know. A big thing of hummus, some baby carrots, and some goat juices or whatever, and call it a day.
You got to give a shout out to one of our guests from last season, Julia Gilmore. One night after a show, she was telling me she's going back to her room with her hot plate and broccoli. And I mean, she's making a full meal on a hot plate back in her hotel room to stay healthy. I mean, I love that she had that dedication. It was like, I wished I could have been that, you know, focused or diligent. All right,
here's how I feel, honestly. And maybe it's not very good for my health, but if I'm traveling to these different places, I want to see what they got.
There's that too. Absolutely. You want to experience it.
You know, and we have our special spots, and it's like, I know if I'm going to Fort Worth, I'm probably going to the Flying Saucer. I'm going to have a couple beers and a burger. You know, it's not the best for me, but either are art shows. And, you know, life is life. You got to do this life. Shit.
Right.
Just, you know, how are you going to, I don't know. So, no, I'm not going to eat the steamed whatever.
But, you know, like we talked last week with a Stand Up and Live, that's been something that I haven't done since like 2 or 3 years ago, is I am such a good cook, and I love to cook, and I've been cooking again. And it's been something fun that Renee and I can share and try new meals. And I really encourage people, if you get in a rut, start making new meals. That's a good way to find inspiration right there. It works.
New York Times. That's me, baby. New York Times cookbook thing, whatever that app is. I use that all the time. Try to work new stuff in. That's they don't put any crap on there. That and just tacos. Tacos are the best way to eat anything.
Absolutely.
Like, there's a tortilleria right around here, and it's like, I get a big pack of tortillas, make some pico de gallo, and then it's like, well, bean tacos one night and shrimp and then fish, and you know, let's get Bill the Kid in here, shall we?
Yes, we shall. Billy the Kid, let's bring him on.
Let's get him in here.
All right. We have Bill Kid, ceramic sculpture artist, the man, the myth, the legend, coming up next after this quick break. This episode of the Independent Artist Podcast is brought to you by Zap. the digital application service where artists and art festivals connect.
Douglas, I'm thrilled this week that we are being sponsored and supported by Zapplication.org.
It's really great that they appreciate what we're doing here on the podcast.
And I appreciate what they are doing, basically because I feel like I am an intensely lazy man. And they make the entire art show process signing up for shows a lot easier.
And you know, they have that tagging feature for us. That way we can put little notes about a show to help us maybe with building that perfect tour.
Or you can write whatever you want on it. You can write, hey, this show sucked last year, but it had promise. Uh-huh. It's going to be exactly what you need it to be. And I appreciate that extra bonus feature.
Yeah, me too. Bill, we're so happy to see you. We're so glad you could join us on the podcast this week.
Well, I'm really glad you guys are having me on.
It's one of those ones. Douglas mentioned your name to me and I'm like, oh my God, how do we not have you on in the first, like, I don't know, two or three that we had on. You've been kind of a fixture in our art show world for a long time and kind of one of our rock stars, really. I mean, you've Definitely. Been out there doing this.
Well, you know, that's very kind of you to say. I kind of feel like I'm just kind of a humble potter, and I've had a lot of good fortune in this career, and it's nice to get the respect from you guys.
Oh, so man. Thank you. You're great.
How long have you been doing this, Bill?
You know, I've been doing shows for about 37 years.
Holy crap.
Wow. Yeah, long time. Back in the beginning, though, I was teaching school, so I didn't do as many shows as I've done in the last, you know, the first 10 years. I was kind of just getting my feet wet in the business. And then the last, you know, started really kind of envying everyone's traveling around the country and doing this for a living. And I continued with my teaching career and just kind of kept doing more and more shows along the way. And now that I'm retired, I'm just really, really doing it a lot.
How quickly did that wear off, that envy?
You know, it's funny you say that, because I really was very envious. I'd do a lot of shows in Florida that were only maybe 3 hours from my home. Mm. And I would leave Friday after work and do the show and then get back Sunday night, go to work again. And
oh, wow.
I know everyone else was kind of taking it easy on Monday and this and that, but.
Yeah.
You know,
we've always called those Mondays that kind of Mack truck Monday, just a full body hangover, really. Mm-hmm. Just everything kind of hurts. And man, I don't envy you getting right back into work and into that teaching kind of grind.
And were you teaching ceramics or what were you?
I did teach ceramics. So I kind of ran my program like a college level class, even though it was high school.
Oh, okay.
I'd get the kids going on projects. I always made sure when I had a show that weekend that they were in the middle of a project. So Monday morning, I didn't have to tell them too much. They could come and get their materials and continue on while I'm trying to wake up.
That's smart. They knew what to do. Yeah, just come
in
there and get to work.
Somewhat. Yeah.
Cool.
Oh, cool. So one thing we've talked about on the podcast, oftentimes, and I know this is more like on the college level, so maybe it doesn't apply, but the whole idea of doing art shows is something that maybe like a college art teacher wouldn't encourage or maybe wouldn't even advocate that it's a legitimate type of place for us out here. I mean, did you ever have any of that push and pull with that, with how you felt about this being an educator and, you know, doing shows outside?
Well, you know, I was actually very fortunate. When I went to school, I studied with John McCoy. He was my ceramics professor, and he wasn't the type of person that was all academic and saying, oh, you just got to do galleries or, you know, that's not a viable way to sell your work or present your work. And he actually did some shows himself. I know he always talked about doing the Piedmont Park show in Atlanta, like a 9-day show. And he kind of got me into looking at that as a possible way of selling my work or getting my work out there. Mm. So I was kind of fortunate that way. So, you know, had I had a professor that sort of poo-pooed that idea of doing shows, I may never have gotten into this business. Who knows?
I think that's interesting, because what you do with your work is that it is very sculptural. It's not a traditional, what you'd see ceramicist on the street kind of with mugs and plates. And right. I'm certainly not downplaying that at all. It's just not what we see out of your work. It does seem like more of a kind of a headier gallery or something. You know, you certainly could have transitioned into that instead, I think.
Yeah, it's possible that I could have gone a different route, but I think I was always kind of a down-to-earth, kind of humble person. You know, I was a hard-working person. And actually, from thinking back to an earlier part in my life, My mother actually did craft fairs, but she did these country craft fairs. So I think some of that, I just knew that she'd go out on the weekend and she would have all this product that she made and she sold it. So I think some of that might have been ingrained in me that way too.
Okay.
And being clay, you know, it is a craft to some degree. And when I was learning in college, I was learning about how to make mugs and plates and bowls and jars and things like that. So early on, I got into this art fair business and, you know, I wanted to be able to sell my work and because you can produce a lot of it when you're making small things and, you know, that's probably how it all came about really.
When I first met you in the early 2000s, I remember we had a conversation about when you made that shift from kind of focusing on functional work to what you're making now, or, you know, more sculptural work. And you had said, I'm just having so much fun with it. I'm so glad I made that shift. And I don't remember when it happened, or can you talk about when you kind of made that change?
It was going on probably about 20 years ago, more or less.
Okay.
I've been, you know, the first time I got my hands dirty with clay was about 40 years ago. And I never did, in a sense, functional work. I did decorative, like pottery forms. I would do jars and vessels and things that were carved. They looked more utilitarian, but they were still kind of decorative. And then one day after, say, 20 years of just throwing pots and doing these decorative things, I took some of these thrown forms and just started altering them and playing around. And it was very fun. I started seeing all these organic shapes and organic kind of possibilities of things that were kind of coming out of that. More kind of fruit and vegetable seed-like maybe in the beginning, and it seems like it's kind of morphed more into sea life and things like that. But yeah, it was very exciting, and it's still exciting today because there's been 20 years of evolution of this work, and you know, I keep trying to push it a little bit further. And, you know, as long as I'm having fun doing it, and it seems to be received well in the industry or at these shows, yeah, I'll keep doing it.
I love the fact that you bring a little bit of fantasy to it, but you bring fantasy to it within this realm of a world that seems like it exists anyway, whether it's germs or spores or sea life or I just love kind of walking past your booth and seeing that kind of, I mean, you can tell you're having fun with it. It's purely original work, but it's like, you know, you can't just do abstract painting without learning how to draw. You have to learn how to hold on to the clay and work it and do these functional things almost or figure out how the clay works before you can really say.
Well, that's exactly it. I think, you know, there's no shortcut to gaining the skill and the technique. And by making all these pots over the years, I really honed in on the skills and knew how to put things together. I understood the clay very well. Had I had these ideas when I first started out, it would have been a disaster. I just wouldn't have had the skill set to carry it off and make it look like anything that was worthy of being out there, you know?
Right. So to be kind of more specific, like let's say you learn an effect from a glaze or whatever that you kind of file back in there and you're like, oh, I can use this technique in a more sculptural thing I'm trying to realize or something.
Yeah. The main glaze that I actually use that is on the surface of almost everything I make is a glaze I developed probably 5 years before I ever started doing this body of work. I was sort of using it, this crawl glaze that creates that nice kind of bumpy textured surface. I was kind of inlaying it in some of the carved things I was doing, but I was also using many other glazes at that time in a similar way, just with different color and textured effects. So when I actually started doing these organic pieces, it was the perfect surface for me to work with. But that in itself, that glaze is just white. It has no color to it. So I would figure out what underglazes I could use under it or over it, what oxides I could put with it. Because some things you'd think, oh, this is going to be a great color. And then you fire it up and all of it flaked off under your shelf because it just wasn't compatible. So, you know, years and years of development to find out what works and what doesn't work and how to tweak it to make it work. Yeah, it's just it's a learning process. And I've got, you know, really good control of what I'm doing now. But when I want to introduce a few new colors, it's a whole nother going back and testing and making sure it's going to react with the chemistry and the kiln and everything to make it actually come out. So that's kind of fun because you keep testing and pushing it and see where it can go.
What I like what Will said earlier is it's not like a literal, like you said, initially you started with like fruit and vegetable type forms or whatever. So it's not like a literal reflection of a pair or whatever. It's not something that exists, but it has elements that exist already in nature or in science or whatever. And so it seems like it's this whole new thing, but it's inspired from something else. And I love that that sets the viewer's mind wild to be like, oh, this is like a whole different thing, you know? I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I think the human nature or the viewer typically wants to identify with it. They want to relate to something that is in something of their knowledge, something they've seen before. But it kind of gives them, you know, this intrigue, or it has this mystery about it to where, you know, when they start really looking at it, they're like, well, yeah, this isn't sort of like that, but it's not really that at all. So, yeah, I think it makes the viewer really kind of consider it for what it is and, you know, whether they can put a label on it. I think the majority of people, their first thought is, well, this looks like sea life. But when you actually look at it, it kind of resembles it in some ways. It has some of the elements of it, but it really, you know, when you take a close look at it, it's not really that at all. So,
do you ever study or just pick up science books and look through different things for inspiration?
Yeah, exactly. I have a really good book on seeds, you know, and book on pollen that I used to use quite often when I was sort of first developing my work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the last probably 10 years, I don't use a lot of visual references. I think my work, I get ideas from my own work now. It's like I can take this idea and I can combine it with another idea that I've been doing and somehow figure out a way to create a new piece with some of those elements, taking from this, taking from that, but then somehow synthesizing that together and, you know, see where it goes. And oftentimes it creates a whole new avenue for me to explore.
I love that. Yeah, drawing inspiration from your own work. That's kind of inspirational to me too, just kind of thinking about, I don't know, figuring out new directions to go in. And because sometimes I'll just go back and look through old ideas and realize that they weren't quite taken far enough, or I could take them where I'm more skilled now. Just kind of drawing from, I'm more capable of saying what I want to say, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. It was probably about 6 months ago, I had to deliver a piece to a client who had bought some work maybe 8 or 10 years ago from me. And I didn't realize what they had bought. I walked in and I said, oh my God, I looked at a couple of these pieces that were sort of something I did in a way, a trial or a test piece that I visited once. Mm-hmm. And I kind of almost forgot I even made it.
Okay,
and I had to look at it and go, wow, that's kind of cool. You know, so it's like, maybe I need to go back and sort of push that idea a little bit further.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because I've done a lot of different playing around with things. Sometimes I might not actually, and in the moment, think it's that great. And I've put it at a show and it sells right away. And I kind of almost forget about it. And then when I was able to actually come across something, because I don't document very much of my work at all as far as photographs and things. I make a lot of work and, you know, it comes and goes and some pieces are similar, but when you have something that really kind of stands out from the pack and you're kind of wondering, is this like really any good at all? And it's gone before you can really get any kind of feedback from it or even artists' opinions of what it looks like.
Do you sometimes feel like it's a fluke, like you sell that thing and you're like, wait a minute, I mean, was it luck that this person bought it? Will it have mass appeal? Will other people like it? You know what I mean? It's almost like you didn't get enough time to spend with it.
Well, that's true. That's what I'm saying. I was in someone's home and it really just, I could not even remember when I made that piece or, you know, it wasn't so drastically different from what I do, but it was different enough to where it really caught my attention.
Okay.
We're getting too old not to document this stuff now, Bill. You gotta something now or just forget it.
You're gonna have to use that iPhone that has some ceramic dust up into the microphone port there.
Yeah, I need to put Daria to work to document a little bit more of my thing.
Well, before we go any further, we need to send out a huge shout out to Daria, because thank you to her for making this whole thing happen. We did a little troubleshooting and we needed her help, didn't we?
Well, you know, without her, I would probably not be sitting here right now talking to you guys.
We all have our in-house tech support. That's Douglas's son, Oliver, got us going when we first started the podcast.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Very instrumental in getting figuring out where all the plugs go. I still don't right. know. Well,
Oliver!
I'm pretty good sitting behind my potter's wheel, but put me on a computer and I, you know, if something goes wrong, I can't fix it.
I'm with you. I'm with you on that. So you mentioned retiring. You were talking about retiring as far as with your teaching right. career. How long did you teach and do shows at the same time?
Well, I taught for 30 years.
Wow.
And I was doing shows pretty much. I did a few shows when I first started teaching. Mm-hmm. When I first got my first teaching job, it was inner city Miami. I had never student taught. I was 22 years old. I wasn't into art at all at the time, as far as like thinking about it as a career. So my wife started teaching theater at the age of 22. She was teaching high school. And we had gotten married young. She said, "Well, why don't you go into teaching?" And I was like, "You know, I don't really think I'm the greatest student or anything. I don't know if teaching would be for me." She goes, "Well, you always like working with your hands. You like art. You like to build things. Why don't you think about doing something like that?" So I kind of listened to her, and I enrolled in several different art studio classes, and one being ceramic, okay. and it was a hand-building class. I got in there, and I just kind of started seeing what people were making with clay and got really kind of excited about it. And that was kind of the beginning of it all. So I continued on taking those classes and taking other design classes, learning about art a little bit. And clay just was my thing. I really wanted to do this. So I got my teaching certificate. I got my degree, my Bachelor of Fine Arts with teaching. Although you're supposed to do a student teaching thing for like 6 months. Or whatever, before you go into the classroom.
Okay.
And she said, "Well, you can actually get a job without that. You don't really have to do that." So I went to the main person, Lilia Garcia in Miami, who's the head of Dade County Public Schools. And she got me a job in the inner city and put me right in there. And I was miserable. I had no idea how to run a classroom. I was teaching all types of art. I was just trying to survive.
Oh, wow. Did they eat you alive?
They were kind of eating me alive. They loved being in my class, but I really didn't have that great of control. I was a little too laid back, not a great disciplinarian. But anyway, I stuck it out. I was married. I wanted to make sure I wasn't just a failure. So right. I stuck it out. And after 3 years of hard time in the inner city, I actually got a call saying there's a teaching job for just teaching ceramics across the county at another school. And I got over to do that. And that's when everything kind of turned around. I got to do exactly what I wanted to do.
Okay.
I started learning a little bit more about teaching. I started doing my own work a little bit in the school. I guess there were 2 or 3 years I only did like 2 or 3 art shows local. Wow. I wasn't able to produce a lot of work. I was kind of, working my way through trying to stay alive in the teaching thing. And then I got over there and I started making work. I started working with the kids, and that's kind of where it all kind of blossomed.
So let me ask, it seemed like when you got into that career path, it was about teaching, making a living, and whatever. So what I'm interested in is, what made the leap to then do the shows when you already had this other job? Was it really like you felt more of this draw to selling your work and getting your work out into the public?
Yeah, I think ultimately I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be someone that could produce art, sell it, and make a living from it.
Okay.
And early on, I didn't have this enough talent or skill set or whatever to get in there and actually feel like I could make a living. So the teaching was a way that it didn't put pressure on me to actually have to make money doing shows. Mm-hmm. So I would make whatever I kind of wanted and to the best of my ability and go take it out there to the shows and see what happened, see what kind of response I would get. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of early on doing a lot of raku firing and things like that because I didn't know much about glazing and this and that or really have any kind of voice. I was still kind of learning, okay. How to make something.
Well, you started doing those shows like you did a couple. And I mean, what I found to be, when I first started doing my kind of this body of work, I was doing a different thing with my ex. And then, I did my own body of work and all of a sudden it gave it that salary boost. I was doing what I wanted to do and it kind of boosted it. Did you kind of get a little taste early on too? Or you?
I was not making enough money in the first couple of years of doing shows, really to feel like I was going to be able to contribute enough to my marriage and to really just be able to jump out there and do this. I didn't really have the ability.
Right.
I was watching people go to these shows, and that's why that when I was talking about earlier being envious, I saw artists that were out there doing this on the weekends. They were making enough money to survive and doing it. And I felt like I want to get there, but I didn't really know how to get there exactly. Mm-hmm. So I continued on with teaching, and I think my talent kept rising up. So after about maybe 8 or 10 years of making work from the very beginning, all of a sudden I started applying to shows like Coconut Grove and Cherry Creek and places. And I started getting into all these shows,
wow, yeah. You know,
and it was like, wow, you know, people were like, wow, you got into Cherry Creek. You know, that's like a great thing. And I didn't really know at the time. I just heard it was a good show. You know, right. I think 1997 was the first year I went out there. And to me, I thought I made a ton of money, but I think everyone around me probably made 2 or 3 times more than I did,
yeah.
You know, but it was kind of like, all right, I might be able to do this for a living. Mm. But by that time, you know, I was already 12 years into teaching, and I was like, we had a couple of kids already. And then I started weighing family life and art show life. Mm-hmm. I knew I could make a living, but I didn't want to be hustling too much on the road all the time while my kids are growing up, and I'm just trying to really make ends meet. So I wanted to continue to teach because it was stable and I could continue to develop my work and, you know, again, not have to make a lot of money from it mm-hmm. in order to support my family.
But was that switch in mind? Was that like the long goal? Like at some point I'll be able to do this because I won't have the little kids or I won't have that. Yeah.
You know, that was kind of it. I after, you know, you're 20 years in, you're kind of like, all right, I can do this. I can make a living. But now I've 10 more years, I could retire and have a pension for the rest of my life.
Okay, yeah. That was the next carrot.
the practical side of me, I would have kind of liked to have get out of the classroom because it was a grind. You know, I was having fun doing the shows. I was, you know, making more money at that point than teaching, which, you know, teachers don't get paid a ton of money. But it was kind of nice having that income. I was able to put all my kids through college without them having to take out loans, and I was contributing and doing what I wanted to do for my family and still being there for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd be gone on the weekends, but during the week I was home and going to school just like they were. So yeah, I worked hard.
Yeah. You did work hard. That's incredible. It's a little bit easier. I don't know if it's easier, but it's maybe the paycheck at least is reliable. We're out there on the road and it's like, well, my paycheck, it rained the last 3 weekends, so no paycheck.
Exactly.
You know,
and I knew that was a possibility, and I didn't want to, I guess I wanted to keep the stress off of what I was creating in a sense.
Yeah.
Like I knew in the end, yes, I'm making some money from what I'm doing, but is that going to continue? Is that going to last? So mm-hmm. when I finally did retire in 2017, I had this whole weight lifted off my shoulders. And when I found out how much I was going to have to pay for insurance after that, we retired on the same day. Oh. It was like, wow, that's going to take a big chunk of our pension right there just to mm-hmm. pay for health insurance.
Right.
And we know where we're at with our retiring from the teaching profession. Mm-hmm. So it was still a little bit of pressure in a way because we're 55, but it was like, let's do it. And then ever since I've just really enjoyed doing these shows mm-hmm. and I've been, you know, unbelievably happy and grateful and people are supporting me and, you know, life is grand for me right now. I got to be honest with you.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I love hearing that, yeah. Bill. That's really, really cool. I wanted to ask you, you said something about kind of being around Florida, and I think there's something really attractive to the fact that, like you talk about being able to stick around your own home state, and I'm jealous of that because I do so much traveling. And I know there's a huge art market that I haven't tapped here in Santa Fe. That was the whole point. I just sit here in my studio and still travel 1,700 miles to do these shows.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it does pull me away from family and it is hard. I guess my question is being in Florida and being influenced maybe by the ocean and the sea life and in your work, does that keep you from having to travel maybe as far as you necessarily have to? Can you make a living just in Florida, just doing those shows?
You know, I can, and I think a lot of it's because I do have that pension. You know, if I really needed to, I could buckle down and survive off of that.
Are you doing any shows outside of Florida, or are you pretty much staying?
The last show I did out of Florida was in 2022, not that long ago. I did go out and do Cherry Creek, and I did Rittenhouse Square. I did several shows, you know, that were pretty good distances to travel. And then I decided, well, you know what? I'm going to 2023, I'm not going out of Florida. I'm going to do shows from October through April and just take 6 months off or five and a half months
awesome.
Off. And I really had a great summer. I found I was sleeping, sleeping better at night. Okay. You know, I wasn't even doing any work. I went out of my studio and I always took a break in the summer from doing any work period so I could refresh and get, you know, regroup. Mm-hmm. Kind of followed the school year, basically, with me working in my studio. So I always need that break. And that was when I would get on the road and do these out-of-state shows and take these long road trips. And I enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm resolved to I'm only going to stay in Florida. It's a good enough market for me with my work being the way it is. You know, it doesn't work for everyone. But I can do well in other places, but I don't really need to chase it so much anymore.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm happy about that.
I wondered because I remember seeing you, like, we were longtime neighbors across the street from each other at, like, Lakefront or whatever. And I haven't seen you at some of those more national shows. And I was wondering if you were sticking around Florida.
Yeah, I am. And I, you know, sometimes I miss it when I know those shows are going on. But then I think back and I go, well, I didn't have to drive three long days to get to that art show. And, you know, they're definitely better quality shows as a whole. I mean, the potential is probably better to make more money in those places, but it also costs a lot more money to do, for one thing.
That's a great point. And that's what I wanted to hear you kind of talk on, the fact that Douglas and I have kind of gotten into a little bit of a trap here where we talk about some of the, you know, the A show and this show and that. And the fact is you can make a living not doing that. You know, you don't have to do the show with a $1,000 booth fee. You can do the show with a $200 booth fee without the hotels and maybe have a higher quality of life, you know, not doing all of the traveling necessarily.
Yeah. You know, I think it, everyone wants to kind of, there's a little ego involved in every artist. You want to be able to say, oh yeah, I do Cherry Creek. I do this.
I think it's huge. I think the ego thing is huge.
And I've done pretty much all the shows that I ever wanted to do. I don't really have to prove anything to myself or maybe to anybody, if you want to put it that way. And I can go to some of these little shows in Florida. They're a couple hours from home, maybe. Like you say, they're a couple $100, maybe $300 for a booth for the weekend. Very low cost. If it rained out, you're not like losing tons of money.
Right.
Sometimes you're a big fish in a small pond. You can actually make some money doing that.
The thing about Florida, too, that's so amazing is that there's so much wealth up and down the coast there that, you know, you could show up at a show that maybe isn't registering as a top 10 or something. It's the customers. It's the customers that show up and you got the right thing. You make the right thing and they want it. And there you go.
Well, you know, and in Florida, most of these folks live somewhere else.
Right.
Anyhow, they have their Florida home. They winter in Florida, but they live in St. Louis. They live in somewhere in the Midwest or, you know, Colorado even or wherever. Yep. They just winter in Florida. So they've seen you in all these other places and maybe they purchased the piece from me for their Florida home, even if they bought it in St. Louis. Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, they could just buy it here and not have to worry about shipping it or anything.
Yeah. We've all shipped to Florida outside of it and doing these big shows.
So one thing I wanted to ask you, which is always uncomfortable to talk about, is the awards. I mean, you're an award winner. You win top awards, the Coconut Grove Festival this year, by the way. Congratulations. Best in show. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That was unbelievable. I was not expecting that at all.
It wasn't unbelievable to the rest
to
of us.
Any of us, Bill. Right?
Well,
we were like, okay,
you.
Cool. that makes sense.
Makes total sense.
Well,
makes sense to us.
You guys are very kind. I appreciate
that. But I guess, you know, the thing I think about that is some people, that's kind of like, I don't know, a little bit the background might be their business model, like going to some of the shows like, say, Winter Park or Gasparilla, where they have those big prize money shows. You know what I mean? Do those kind of register on your radar because they have such great prize money?
Not as much the bigger ones, but believe it or not, the smaller ones. There's some shows in Florida that have $5,000 best in show and some of these B shows that's the same as Coconut Grove. $5,000 best in show.
Okay. You're going to get a bunch of people poaching your schedule. You better watch out.
Well, you know what? Bring it on. I've already told other artists, you know, okay, I wouldn't recommend you traveling too far to do this show, but hey, there is pretty good prize money. And, you know, if you're here, may as well give it a try, you know?
Definitely.
There's just such a small handful of collectors in some of these places. So it could be hit or miss. You could actually show up at some of these little places where you wouldn't expect to make any money, and you know, you sell to three or four people, and it could make your show.
Yeah.
And then if you win a nice prize on top of that, it can be pretty good.
Definitely. If you can pull a Cherry Creek out of a Cracker Barrel parking lot, more power to you, you know, just do it.
Screw the ego and fill those pockets full of cash.
Screw the ego and just, it's all right. Yeah.
Thanks, Bill. I was really interested in learning about that kind of, how you make a living just in your own home state. And not doing the traveling and letting some of those bigger shows kind of come to you. And yeah, I find that really appealing. The more happily married I am, the more I want to stay home with my wife and not travel. So just try to figure it out.
I don't know if you want to live in Florida, but you know, there's so many shows in Florida, and you know, like I said,
it might not
be the market for everyone, but it does work for me.
So. That's awesome. Yeah.
So you were talking about like science earlier, like some of your imagery kind of comes back to that. Do you have an interest in science or a background in science, or is it just that there's something about it that just really works for what you want to create?
I would say it's more like the way, for the most part, the way nature kind of creates its own science in a way, a lot of repetition of forms and, you know, some of my more complicated looking forms are just based on one simple idea. That's just, you know, these forms that are put together over and over and over and over and over again, to where it creates this whole beautiful large form, but it's all kind of like a way like barnacles colonize, you know. It's like one barnacle might not be that interesting, but when you see a whole cluster of them all colonized together, it creates this really kind of elaborate pattern, you know. It's kind of science, but it's a little more nature.
Okay.
You know, and some of the ways I put some of these forms together, it's going back to more of a science or engineering approach. It's kind of like the way a geodesic dome is put together. I have a cone that's supported by another cone. So every little cone that's put together has about five or six different support groups. So it creates this really strong structural form when it's all built without any kind of substructure inside of it.
Cool.
So you're not turning at all. You're sculpting.
I'm throwing a lot of forms on the wheel to create these like hollow cones or spheres or whatever. I'm just putting a lot of forms together.
Interesting.
So I'm some of them I'm cutting in half, but using the wheel as a tool to make hollow forms quickly, because I've been throwing for 40 years, so it's a very easy skill for me. It's faster than pouring slip into a mold or something to create a sphere. I can just throw the form, you know.
Wow.
It doesn't take that long.
Technologically speaking, when you create those kind of hollow forms, and can you attach multiple pieces with, and then do you have to glaze everything at once, or do you kind of attach them after there?
I actually build the whole form as one.
Okay.
Goes in the kiln and gets bisque fired, and then I do all the glaze work and fire it a second time. So
okay.
Yeah, it's all put together before it goes, you know, before it does any kind of color or anything.
Interesting. Do you have like a whole setup of you know, just your tan drying creations just before you?
Well, you know, I work on multiple things at a time.
Sure.
The other day we had really low humidity. I was working in my studio, so I was able to get all these things started and go back to them quick because they're going to start drying out a lot. And, you know, this is Florida, so I'm used to high humidity. Mm-hmm. Couple days later, the atmosphere changed. We had some little bit of rain moved in. I could get all this stuff started and nothing would dry at all, because I have an open air studio. My studio has three sides open completely to the elements on one side.
Cool. That's great.
So there's no air conditioning or heating or anything. It's just natural. It's just a natural atmosphere, like a shed basically.
Yeah.
In my backyard. So I'm totally subjected to the elements. If it's 40 degrees outside, it's 40 degrees in my studio.
Right.
And if it's 90 degrees, it's 90 degrees.
I find that
degrees.
Too in our studio, where it's a garage that is open, all windows and doors. So it's almost like we're outside. But weather changes, temperature changes, that affects, you know, the timing with the glass. And that's what you're explaining with what you got going on.
Yeah, I remember the first time I ever did Cherry Creek, I did an artist demonstration. This is before I was doing this organic work. I was just throwing these big jars and things. And I was doing a demo and talking to an audience, and I didn't even need to use like a heat gun to force dry anything. As I throw it, just talk for a minute, these pieces were drying out and I could just continue throwing and It was amazing. I don't know if I could work in that environment.
It's a nightmare,
really,
honestly. Being in the in the desert and high altitude, and I'm used to, 53 years old. I spent 49 of those years in Virginia, and East Coast like humidity, and the humidity in Virginia. I'm used to my acrylic just flowing.
Yeah, right.
I'm up here in the desert. It's drying on my brush while I'm moving it, and I'm like throwing away all these brushes, and I'm like, what the hell? I couldn't get it. Took me forever to figure out it's
unbelievable how it really affects the medium you're working with.
Definitely. Yeah. It's why they paint in oil up here in Santa Fe.
Exactly.
You have to get all hoity-toity. Got to paint with my pinky out, though.
Well, a conversation I had earlier this year with another artist, I was next to them at an art show. And they're an artist who does art shows and also teach, kind of like how you did as well. They made a comment when they realized that, I was part of the podcast. And he said to me that perhaps an artist who does this full time and makes a living off of their art or whatever, or struggles to make a living off their art, might look down on somebody who has kind of this other career. Have you ever experienced anything like that, that pressure or that feeling? Because for sure, we've talked on the podcast that we don't feel that way, that however anyone can craft a life being an artist with whatever other means to support themselves, that's important. The good thing is that you're doing what works for you. But I guess my question is, did you ever have any pressure with that?
And don't let the fact that Douglas asked the question and then answered it for you sway your answer. You answer the way you
I'm sorry. I put words.
No, I'm teasing you. I'm teasing, yeah.
Well, I think when things were really good for a lot of artists, I think they had a little bit more of an air over me, like, oh, you're teaching and, they're making a lot of money, so they don't need to teach. And then things got a little thin for some of them. And then some of them would be like, wow, you're so lucky you have a teaching job right now. And kind of like, well, I would always kind of say, well, it's really not luck. I really work pretty hard.
Definitely,
I'm doing two jobs. I'm working double time because I really want the stable income, but I also want to be an artist. And so many of my teacher friends, they never did their own work because they said, I don't have the time. So I ran my classroom like it was a university. I would get the kids going on things. I would demonstrate, the first 10 years I would throw these forms on the wheel, and then I would cut them in half, and the kids would be like gasping, oh my God. And then after a while I said, why am I cutting this thing in half? I could keep it, and I could actually turn it into something.
Yeah,
so
right.
I stopped trashing all my demonstrations and started like saving them, and realized there's no reason I need to do this just for the shock value to the kids. I may as well take
it. Yeah. I admire that too, because I always loved those kind of teachers that you'd go into the classroom and you'd learn by example, and they'd be just working, and they're working, and then, they're moving around and they're teaching too. But at the same time, it's like, give you a little bit of freedom. And
you're going to learn so much more if you can watch someone that kind of knows what they're doing with the material and see how they actually, whether it's applying paint or, do sculpting something. If they explain it to you and give you one little demo and then you're on your own, you have nothing to reference back to. But if you can go back and go, oh yeah, I see how you add that texture to this or doing that. And I was totally open. My workstation was right in the classroom. I wasn't hiding off in another room or anything. I was working right there with the kids. And it was kind of fun. I could sit back, like I'd say, especially on Monday mornings, the kids would all walk in and they would just start getting their materials, getting all their stuff, start working. I didn't even have to sit them down and take attendance. I would saw them come in, they'd be working, and it was just flowing. So it was kind of a nice thing. They respected my space and I respected them, and it was a good career.
What's it like teaching like that age group? They were in your classes because it was an elective. They didn't have to be there. It's not like math or English or whatever. So by definition, you might have kids that are a little more interested in art and wanting to learn.
Well, you got a mix because they did have to have a fine art credit. So a lot of them took it because they knew about my classroom and how it was run. It was kind of open. They didn't have a lot of, restrictions put on them. They had a lot, they could talk, they could move around, they could interact with each other. So rather than take a class where they're, you know, they have to sit in their chair and listen to the teacher lecture or this and that. I think they like that. And some of them found their way with clay and found that they really did like making things. Mm-hmm. The biggest downfall in teaching, probably across the board almost, especially in creative arts, was, you know, when the kids all started getting cell phones, mm-hmm. you know, then that became what they wanted to play with in their hands rather than clay. And I saw a real transition when the cell phone really became dominant and kids would have anxiety if you took it away from them. It really kind of changed the dynamics of teaching. And fortunately, I only had to witness that for probably the last maybe one third of my teaching career, because I just saw it really, you know, it really was kind of a sad thing for kids that didn't have any distractions. Here's the clay. This is what we have to work with. There's not another tool we can play around with.
And now post-COVID, the classroom is even harder for teachers. I mean, I'm hearing about teachers getting out of the whole field altogether. It's just too hard.
Yeah, it really is not a good place to be right now, unfortunately. But
hopefully
there's still some that are sticking it out because we need them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hated that when Douglas and you came back from that show. I know the artist that you're talking about, and we actually want to collect his work because we really respond to his work. And I hated that because it's like I really do feel that however you make this work as an artist is admirable. And I love hearing about your story, Bill, and being able to be a teacher for so many years and travel at your own rules and in your own way to make your own living. You know, the way Daryl Thetford talked early on in the show about doing as few shows as possible. Yeah, he and Dolan Guymon had a little contest to see how few shows they could do during a year, you know, and that's admirable for those guys. And that's a totally different business model maybe than the hustle. Yeah. But I like the way that the teachers teach, and I don't know, the way that kind of answers back to our own industry.
Yeah. You know, it's probably good that I wasn't good enough early on to make a living. Because that kind of made me stay in the classroom longer. And once you reach a certain point, you're kind of like, I can't give up this carrot at the end of all this and have some kind of income.
Absolutely.
You know, what if something happens? What if I get in an accident, I lose the use of a hand or something? You know, you don't want to think about that, but it's a possibility, you know? And then I don't want to be someone on disability or whatever, trying to live off the government. Mm-hmm. I want to make my own way, you know?
Right.
Another thing that I think of when I think of your work is how you display your work. You know, you walk through an art show and you see pro panel, pro panel, pro panel. And then you'd walk in and your work fits in the environment that you've created. These hard walls with a very unique color to what you'd see in any other booths. Can you talk about your kind of the decision to make your booth stand out to help make your work stand out?
Yeah. You know, I guess I created this booth, I think it was 2002.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And actually, not the wall color, but when I was thinking about the pedestal design, mm-hmm. I was literally going on a summer trip and I had very limited space in my van. I was doing four shows, Cherry Creek and Des Moines, Ann Arbor, and all these things where I needed to carry as much work as possible. And my pedestals, I'm trying to figure out a way to make them really small and compact. So I actually make them out of cardboard boxes. I built a really nice top and a really nice bottom. The idea was, well, if I can get through the summer with these four shows and this display works and it only makes it through there and I trash it, then I'll figure something out after that.
Okay.
And here it is 22 years later and I'm still basically using the same display. I've only replaced the cardboard twice.
Wow.
Are you serious? Years.
And they're literally just boxes, you know?
Wow.
It's been like unbelievably, I don't know if it's luck. I spray painted them with the cheapest spray paint I could find to make them black and built really nice looking countertops. The wall color, I just got lucky. I wanted something other than white and I knew I wanted sort of a reddish color.
Yeah.
And I just walked in, I looked at all these different paint chips. I picked one and it was kind of the one that seemed to really work. I mean, there may be other ones that work equally as well, but I found the one. It seemed to be the perfect backdrop for my work, and I've been using it ever since.
It fits. I mean, it fits it so well. It's like it's the right environment to showcase your work.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a perfect complement to all the different colors. So
I think about when
it was a little bit of luck.
When I talked to Eric Lee a couple of years ago, and he said what was so important to him when he got on the art fair scene was that he wanted to create a booth that was distinguishable from anybody else, his work, but also like the booth itself. It's like, oh, that's the booth that had like the furniture in it or whatever. You know, it's your booth has got the unique color and it brings them back to the whole picture of your booth and your work. And I think that was a really important decision that you made to do something different than what other people are doing.
It's like a branding, really, right? I mean, isn't that what you're going for?
Yeah, you know, like I said, I wasn't really thinking about as much standing out from other people as I was just trying to make my work stand out. And I think it did both. I think, like you said, you look at so many booths, they're either pro panels that are sometimes black, sometimes beige, sometimes gray. The booth itself doesn't stand out, you know? Mm-hmm. And you have other artists, you know, like Tony Cray. He has a beautiful booth as a glass blower.
That's another
example. He's got this really bright yellow that he's using that just looks dynamite in there.
Right.
You know, and it's his booth's always super clean and really well put together, and it sets off his work great.
Yeah. So I think it's a really good idea to do that, to make your display fit the work and showcase the work, but yet be distinguishable from anybody else. So, yeah.
I agree.
Cool. Well, Bill, this has been awesome. It's really cool to hear your story over the years of being a teacher, being on the road, and what you find inspiration from. So thanks for doing that with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time. It's a valuable kind of lessons here that you've kind of taught us, and just really honestly nice to get to know you a little bit better. So thank you.
Well, I really appreciate you guys having me on, and hopefully I said a few things you can actually...
Something we can air.
actually you can share with other people worthy of. And I look forward to seeing both of you guys in person at a show. Well, of course, you'll have to come to Florida now, so I don't know if that's happening.
I'm back, baby. I got that Florida monkey. I'm going to feed him another cup of coffee next chance I get, so maybe we'll see you down there.
Looks like Florida 2025 is back on for me. I had to take 2 years off of Florida, but
okay.
I'll fill you in later. Everyone who listens to the show knows why I had to do that, but I'll fill you in later on. So.
Okay. Sounds good.
Watch us not get in now. Nobody's getting in.
All right. There you go.
Bye, Bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Right. Take care. Bye-bye.
He's gone, right, Will? He's
yeah,
not...
we can talk about him.
Now we can talk. Let's do it.
All right. Yeah, that's right. And we can tell him how we really feel. Nah, man, what a good guy. I mean, just a legend in our industry. So
it's crazy him talking about retiring from teaching. He doesn't seem to be of that age that he could be retired. I mean, he looks great and it's pretty amazing.
He does. And isn't that more of like a number of years thing as opposed to an age? So he started teaching when he was like 9-10 years old.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Just keep it going.
But no, it made me think about what we talked about in the preamble about the series I was watching about health and all that kind of stuff. And I found it fascinating what they talked about in this series about epigenetics, which it's a new term for me. I hadn't heard it before.
New to me. I don't know. I'm going to the Google machine. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, right. Genetics is the thing that we inherit from our parents and the DNA. You know, we get our, you know, high blood pressure, cholesterol, all that kind of stuff. But the epigenetics is our choices that we make that can either delay those markers getting turned on or enhance them or make them speed up. So that's been my focus ever since I saw that series, that I want to slow down all those things that are in my future and put them off, you know, as far as I can, put them off in the distance.
I've actually decided I've got a new thing I'm going to start up. The fall show announcements are coming out. The late summer announcements are coming out. So I've taken up smoking. I don't know if anybody wants a cancer stick, I'm your hillbilly. No smoking.
That'll be good for the high blood pressure. You said that you were going in to have tests for this week.
Sure. Why not? Chest pains. Watch me have a heart attack and then everybody go back to this episode. Oh, fantastic. That's just great. I got my, I don't know if you can see this here, Douglas, but I've got my, I'm going back to Des Moines this year. I'm excited about going back. I've got my Fong's Kick-Ass Pizza t-shirt on.
Amazing.
So I'm always ready. Talking about going out to favorite spots after shows, have you ever been to Fong's?
I have not.
Oh, man. It's a Chinese food pizza place. And it's like they do like crab rangoon and
those kind of pizzas and like Chinese food pizzas. It's a really quirky, fun spot, and it's got a killer beer list if you're into that kind of thing.
Is it in the neighborhood of the show?
So it's like if you're walking from the Marriott to the Papa John Sculpture Park where the show site is, if you walk about the same distance in the other direction, you can get down there, but it's walking distance.
And, okay.
You'll see a million artists in there, and you just show up. You'll already have a table. It'll be like, oh my God, it's Douglas, and he's a goddamn celebrity.
Walking distance for whom, Mr. Armstrong?
I put my foot in my mouth again by saying foot in my mouth. I am going to stop. Thanks for tuning in to another podcast. Really enjoy your listenership. Special thanks go out to Jeff Zachman this week for kicking us a little bit of funding, helping the keep the wheels on the wagon once again. If you feel so inclined, you are enjoying the show, you want to drop something in the bucket, get your name on the podcast. That's the way. It's not fun drive week, but right. It is always appreciated. How about that?
That's good. That's right. So one more thing before we wrap up here for this week's episode. And that is, I'm happy to say I'm going to be back on the road coming up here. So we're going to be gone, both Will and I, solid for a couple of weeks here in a row.
With us being gone for a long period of time, you'll probably experience some irregularity with your normally regularly scheduled podcast.
That's right.
We're trying to be as regular as we can, but we're 53-year-old men, and we do the best we can, and we'll do what we can.
You know, a good way to be able to follow us when new episodes drop is to go onto your app, your podcast app, hit subscribe, and then when the new episodes come, it just shows right up there on your phone. You get a notification.
We will talk to you when, Douglas. Who gives a shit?
Who
we'll
knows?
See you on the road.
We'll figure it out when we get home.
Stop by and see us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Bye-bye, everyone.
This podcast is brought to you by the National Association of Independent Artists. The website is naiaartists.org.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. That's zapplication.org. And while you're at it, find us on social media and engage in these conversations.
Be sure to subscribe to this podcast to be notified when we release new episodes.
Oh, and if you like the show, we'd love it if you would give us your 5-star rating and offer up your most creative review on your podcast streaming service. See you next time.